So we have been in Joshua chapter 2 and just kind of got into Rahab's story a little bit and just really covered the first couple of verses there. I think really question 1's the only one that we got to, but we're going to be pushing through the questions in Rahab's story a good bit faster than we did in Jonathan's. But where we left Rahab in chapter 1, well, let's just go back in chapter 2, excuse me, and read verses 1 through 3. And we'll just kind of start with that and then pick up and move forward in our study. Joshua chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies, secretly from Shittim, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came to the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. It was told that the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight and searched out the land." And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out our land." So we talked a little bit about Rahab and just kind of introduced her and the situation. Remember, this is really the beginning of the conquest of the land of Canaan. The faithless Israelite generation was prohibited from going in, and they were forced to wander for 40 years in the wilderness because of their unbelief and their disobedience. And so it was their children, those who were 20 years old and under, I believe, that were allowed to enter into the land of Canaan. Only two men from the previous generation, because of their faith, Joshua and Caleb, were allowed to enter in. And so as they crossed, we'll have a map up here in a moment, but as they crossed westward across the Jordan River, the first city that they were going to come to when they entered into Canaan proper was Jericho. And kind of following in the footsteps of Moses, who sent the 12 spies into the land of Canaan, Joshua sends a couple of spies in to do some reconnaissance as well, to bring back news of the city and of the state of affairs that are there, to help them prepare for the impending battle. However, he does so secretly, unlike Moses, who sent them and then brought the whole assembly together and allowed them to discourage the assembly with their lack of faith. And so he sends two spies there, and as they get there, they lodge at the house of a prostitute. And we talked about the reasons that they ended up going to Rahab's house. Several reasons. One of the things you may have noticed as you read through the text was the location of her house. It was on the outside of the city wall, or inside of the city wall. And so there was a ready escape if they needed to get out of there rather quickly. Not only that, but the place of a prostitute's house would not be that uncommon. It was a place of secrecy and anonymity. And so they could probably think, "I'm flying under the radar by going here." And then I also believe that in some sense, they were led there by God, whether directly or indirectly, providentially, we don't know. But God saw Rahab's heart, and he's going to give her an opportunity to express her faith so that she might be saved and protected from the massacre that's coming upon Jericho. So the two spies come in, and somehow their secret's found out. It's discovered that they are indeed men from Israel and that they're seeking to spy out the land of Canaan, particularly the city of Jericho. And as we think about where Rahab's kind of in the valley of decision right here, as she determines how she's going to respond to the fact that now she's got two Israelite spies in the house. The city's on high alert. The king sends a message that says, "I heard the spies are there. Give them up so that we can take them and get rid of them." If you think about the circumstances she would have found herself in, Jericho was a Canaanite city. And remember, one of the things that God is doing, or rather both of them, one of the things that he's doing is he's delivering the promise that he made to Abraham, to give him a land. This is the promised land that was foretold and promised by God to be given to his descendants. But also there's another element there that we may not immediately realize, and that is this is a judgment of God upon the Canaanites. In fact, in this conversation with Abraham, he says, "Your people are going to come back some 400 years later." He says, "Because the destruction of the Ammonites is not yet complete." Meaning, at that point in time, they weren't ready for judgment. In the eyes of God, by whatever measure that was, they were not ready for judgment. Time was going to pass. Their wickedness would fill up, as we saw with Sodom and Gomorrah, as their wickedness filled up and it reached a point where God could handle it no more. And so he had to bring judgment on them. Such was the case for the Canaanites. At the time, they weren't ready for judgment. And God says there's going to be a period of time when my wrath toward their sin is filled up, and then judgment will come. And so he's doing two things here. He's giving the land of Canaan to the Israelites that he promised, and he's also judging the people of the land. So you think about the kind of situation Rahab would have been in. Obviously, she is not one of the more prominent people of the city. She is a prostitute. She's a harlot. And so there's just a great deal of immorality, not only that fills the land for which they're being judged, but also her individual life. And if you think about it, what would stop her from handing these men in? giving them in to protect the city, probably get a reward from the king for delivering up the spies who were going to spy the land out and work against Jericho, probably something beneficial in there for her. And whatever the case was, whatever's going in through her mind, something keeps her hand from moving, not saving her city, and probably just receiving a reward. So the king sends word, and he asks for the people. We'll just move on to question two. What did Rahab tell the king of Jericho when he inquired about the spies?
He didn't know where they were. Well, she did say they were here, but they left.
Okay. So yeah, both of those. Yeah, put both of those together. And then she goes even further than that and kind of sends the men of Jericho, the guards of Jericho, on a wild goose chase. She didn't know where the men came from, like Ronnie said. They were here earlier, like Paul said, and if you hurry up and chase them, this is the way they went, then you can overtake them and catch them. And if you just want to look in verses 4 and 5, the woman had taken the two men, hidden them, and said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." Now, I'm not going to deal with the deceit right here in this particular instance. That's one of the things about Rahab's story that bothers a lot of people. We'll deal with that more so when we get to our discussion questions. We're not going to deal with the deceit of that at the moment. But there's got to be more than a story than we're told. Obviously, the details here that are provided are to help us understand. However, there's got to be more to the story than we know. Somehow these spies were figured out. It was determined and made known to Rahab and even to the king that there were intruders in the land. Now, how that was, we don't know. It's possible perhaps that somebody recognized them because their clothing was different. Maybe somebody picked up on their accent that was different and realized that they weren't from there, or that they were in fact indeed Israelites. Whatever the case was, they're discovered. The king sends soldiers knocking on our door and says, "Give up the men, give up the spies that have come into your house." Now, her lie is convincing because, as they say, the best lies are mixed with a little bit of truth. And she does say, yes, they were here. I'm not going to deny the fact that they were here. They've been seen. They've been discovered. And so she says, yes, they were here, but they left. And they've gone out this way, and this is the way that you need to go. So she throws the soldiers off their trail by saying that they had left when the gate had closed and then encouraging them to follow before the trail got cold. Question three. In actuality, Rahab had hidden the spies where? Okay, among the stalks of flax that were laid on her roof. I find this something of a telling verse, an interesting verse. Normally, whenever you think of a harlot or prostitute, you would probably think she is in the very lowest dregs of society, probably forced into that position, not by desire, but rather on the basis of necessity, that she's got to do this to live. But it seems like there's more to Rahab than meets the eye. She doesn't really seem to meet the stereotypical type of a prostitute. She's got a house, for one. But more than that, it seems like she's some sort of businesswoman, because on her house are these stalks of flax where she's going to be using them to make clothing or selling them as raw material, something like that. Just a brief detail on that. Harper's Encyclopedia of the Bible writes, "The cut flax was tied and set up to dry, then soaked in water for 5 to 15 days to loosen the fibers, after which the fibers were drawn over the edge of a stone or board, beaten with a wooden mallet, and finally refined by combing." Obviously, the flax had been soaking, and it now was laying on her roof where it was drying, and it was going to be prepared to be made into this material from which clothing would be made. I might mention here as well that houses during the ancient world were unlike houses today, oftentimes large, but the houses we're used to seeing anyway are kind of angular. However, back then, houses were flat. That was just the nature of how houses were built. In fact, if you go back in Deuteronomy, kind of interesting, God commanded that the houses be made flat. And as you think throughout Scripture, you see this detail coming up a couple of times. King David, whenever he can't sleep one night and his men are off at war, he gets up and he walks around on the roof of his house. He's not going up and down like we might suspect if we picture their houses looking like ours. But he's on just a flat roof because that's the way God commanded their houses to be made. Jesus makes reference to, in Matthew chapter 6, going to the secret place or your secret room or your inner closet to pray. Oftentimes the Jews would build on their flat roofs a place, just a little room where they could go and quietly get away from everyone And with three kids, I wish that I had a flat roof and a little room on there so I could get away from them once in a while, get some peace and quiet, but it probably wouldn't do any good. They'd follow me up there, I'm sure. But they would often have that place where they could go, get away from the hustle and bustle of life, meditate, spend time with God in prayer. That was just designed into to their houses. And so it was common back then for houses to have flat roofs. And so she's got this flax that's drying up on the roof of her house. And it's underneath these stalks of flax that she hid the spies. So Rahab's redirection was successful. They believe her lie. They pursued the spies all the way to the Jordan River. After which, after the soldiers leave, Rahab goes and she speaks to the spies. What does she confess to them when she goes and speaks to them after the guards had left?
Verse 2 and 9, that she
had,
that she knew that God had given the land to them.
Okay.
Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, let's just read verses 9 through 11, and that's part of it, Dick, exactly. And now, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know, verse 9, Joshua 2, that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and when you what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So she tells them essentially, I know the Lord is giving you the land like you said, Dick. The Lord is your God, He is God, or the Lord's your God, He is God, in heaven above and on earth below. So we see here essentially, in this moment, these are the most important verses of the chapter, because this is why Rahab's story is preserved and included for us in the Bible. It's her faith, her belief, that drives her actions into peacefully receiving the spies, risking her own life, and protecting them. So you stop and think, and I've mentioned before the this type of structure that God seems to use as He communicates in the revealing of His Word. And this may be more technical than some would gather from this text. But as you think about kind of how this text breaks down from this stylistic perspective, literary design, three things we notice here. One, we notice God's power. And these are all kind of built out from each other. You'll see what I mean as we kind of look at verses 9 through 11. You notice God's power. She says and gives reason. There's what drove her to the point of faith was the power of God. And two things that she says that she realized that are going around in Jericho, word that has been spread. Verse 10, we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea when you came out of Egypt. So that's one demonstration of God's power. Now, understand that Rahab was living in a much different time than we are. These days, people want evidence. They say, you want me to believe in God? Give me proof. Give me evidence. Show me a sign. Show me something that compels me to believe. We live in the age of skepticism. Show me and I'll believe. And so if you want someone to believe, you've got to convince them these days. The ancient world had no problem at all accepting the supernatural. And so as rumors begin to spread about what had happened with the Israelites and what had happened there among Egypt, Jericho, if you especially think of its proximity to Egypt, Jericho is probably a small town, probably smaller than most of us think. But it was a small city in contrast to many of the other much larger cities that we think of in the Bible. But it was probably only 50 miles or so from Egypt, maybe less proximity-wise from Egypt. And these events had happened over 40 years ago. And so, yes, even though word would have traveled slowly, it would have been made known to the people of Jericho what had happened, how this nation of slaves and the power of their God had broke the back of the most powerful nation in the world, that is Egypt, and somehow news of him parting the Red Sea and leading Egypt across had made its way over. So one of the events that she refers to that brings her to this point of faith, this is the power of God as the Red Sea was dried up. And secondly there, this reference to Sihon and Og, kings of the Amorites, whom were utterly destroyed by them. So anybody want to answer, who are Sihon and Og? Kind of refresh our memories on that. What's she referring to? Who are they?
Well, they were...
Miss Johnny?
They were... Og was the land of giants.
Okay. In fact, both Sihon and Og. Is that what you were going to say, Dick?
Something like
that. So Og was the king of Bashan and Sihon king of the Amorites. And what was notable about their defeat, as Miss Johnny pointed out, was that these were giant kings. So not only do the Israelites escape from Egypt, cross the Red Sea, but then they go and they thrash the baddest guys on the east side of the Jordan. That is these two giant kings, Sihon and Og. And so appreciate for a moment the nature of Rahab's faith. It's very much like ours. It wasn't a faith that was produced from a first-hand experience. Rather, it was based off of trusting on things that were told to her. As today, we hear the gospel and we believe the gospel. We don't have the ability to witness or to see those sort of things, but our faith is produced by the works of God as they have been preserved and revealed for us. And it was the same thing that produced faith within her. News of what God had done. News of God's power and God's might. And so God's power produced within her, before we get to faith, God's power produced within her this fear. Verse 9, the terror of you has fallen on all of us. And in verse 11, our hearts melted and no courage remained in anyone any longer because of you. And so word spread about not just Israel, but more particularly their God and what He has done for His people. And so as these great demonstrations of power are performed and word begins to spread throughout Canaan, it produced within the people of Jericho this great sense of fear. Now, what happened is, you'll remember, the faithless generation, they refused to go into Canaan. And so what God forced them to do was to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Well, they weren't just wandering the entire time. What they were doing as they were on the east side of the Jordan River is they were systematically taking over the various nations and various kings that were there, overthrowing the cities, and essentially taking possession of everything on the east side of the Jordan River. That's largely what was done during the 40 years of wandering. And so if you think about it from the perspective of the people of Jericho, you've got Jericho right there just very close to the west side of the Jordan River. And Israel's been marching around here, just beating everybody down, taking over the land. And so the people of Jericho know that they are going to be one of the next ones who are going to be up for attack whenever the children of Israel prepare to cross over. So if you kind of think about that, it's obvious that they would have had their eyes set on the city of Jericho, which was a fortified and powerful and important city. And so because of what they'd done and because of the power of God that was being spoken about, the people in the city began to fear. All of the city of Jericho had heard the report of God's power, and all of the people in Jericho were afraid, meaning that they believed. Because they believed, it's evidenced by the fact that they were afraid. So they believed that Israel's God had done these great things. But notice, it's interesting, despite the fact that everyone believed that Israel's God was real and was leading them victoriously throughout the land, one person had saving faith. Everybody believed, but it's that demonic belief, right? The fear, the belief that simply fears and trembles and then does nothing. You can appreciate maybe the fact that all of Jericho believed because they were afraid, but they all went and suited up and got ready for war. Rahab was the only one whose belief was strong enough to cause her to side with God. And so you have God's power, which is instilled within the people of Jericho, this fear, which instilled within Rahab personally a different response, and that is faith. And we see this personalized. She says in verse 9, I know the Lord has given you the land. And then she says, the Lord your God, He is Lord of heaven, God of heaven, and God of earth. So evidence of God's power produces fear, and that fear produced faith. Now, while fear led the rest of the city of Jericho to prepare for war, fear led Rahab to side with the God of Israel. And the Canaanite had many gods. They had a pantheon all their own, two of which particular would be Baal, who we're very familiar with, who was the storm god. He had the power over wind and rain and clouds, and also the god of fertility, and Ashtoreth, who was the goddess of love and war. And she freely recognizes the God of Israel is the one true God, the God of heaven and earth, denouncing her gods and confessing faith in the one true God. Interesting, maybe you picked up on this detail or not. How does Rahab refer to the God of the Israelites?
Lord.
Okay. Lord, what's unique about that term? Anybody know? When you see Lord, and Lord is obviously just a generic term for someone who's in a position of power, and oftentimes it's used in reference to God. When you see it in all caps in your Bible, do you know what it indicates? Okay. When you see, and you'll notice in your Bible, look in verse 10, verse 9, verse 11, where all of those instances where she says, I know, in verse 9, I know that the Lord, you'll notice that's all in caps there. I know that the Lord has given you the land. When you see Lord in all caps in reference to God, what's behind that word in the original language is Yahweh. And the significance of that is that Yahweh is the personal name of God, and it is the covenant name of God. So there are different ways to express God. In fact, Elohim is one of the common ways that God is referred to. In fact, it's the most common way in the Hebrew, the Greek, Hebrew term Elohim. And it can sometimes be used in reference to God, to Jehovah God as we know Him. However, it's oftentimes also used in regard to the false gods of the pagans, the Canaanites, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. The same word in the Hebrew, Elohim, may be used. But when you see Yahweh in the Hebrew, that's always in reference to God, and it's always in reference to His covenant name with His people. That's how He reveals Himself to Moses in Exodus chapter 3, when He says, I am who I am. Okay, that's the covenant name of God. He says, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they didn't know me by this name. I didn't reveal myself to them in this covenant way. Okay, but He reveals Himself to the people and He says, Yahweh. That's the covenant name of God, is the one who's there. And so, as she's using this name, don't miss the significance of that, because this is a personal confession of faith that she has, denouncing not only the Canaanite gods, but expressing her confidence in Yahweh. The covenant name for God, the one true God. And you may too note the power of the chiasm there. This is kind of how the text is broken down literarily, where you've got verses 9 and 11, the faith aspect. Verses 9 and 11, you've got the fear aspect. And verses 10 and 11, verse 10 is the emphasis of God's power. The central part of the structure here is always what the text is driving at, what the text is trying to emphasize. And so while faith and fear are products of this, God's power is what's being elevated, just as this is being recorded. So we notice here a common progression of faith, which is evidence, which produces fear, which produces faith. And if you stop and think about that, as it comes to salvation, as it comes to us knowing the Lord, such is a very similar process for us. You have evidence. Oftentimes it's revelation, God's Word, as it's been revealed by the Holy Spirit, and the things that it has communicated to us that brings us to the point of fear, which brings us to oftentimes the point of faith. Or maybe it's in times of old, it was signs from God, something miraculous that demonstrated His power, but that was what gave the evidence of the reality of God. Or maybe it's someone who starts down the path by just observing the created world and has seen the created world, the power of God, and that gives them, sends them this on this journey to search for whatever it was that made this. And so evidence, which then produces oftentimes fear, when you realize who you are in the presence of God, and you realize your state in the presence of God, that should produce within anyone who is capable of reasoning this out fear, and then oftentimes that fear then leads us to faith. So, is faith simple belief? We talk about this frequently, but we can't reiterate this enough. No. Faith is not simple belief. Many people were banking their salvation on the fact that they made a confession of Jesus as Lord. Or maybe that they asked Jesus into their heart. Or maybe that they were baptized. And they're banking their salvation off of this thing they did a long time ago. And they think that that's good enough and that's going to make them right with God. But you see here what faith is. As you consider all of its implications, Rahab's faith was the truth by which she reordered her life. Okay, she reordered her life by choosing her faith and her trust in God over her nation. She chose faith at the risk of her life. She chose faith over her past religion. She chose faith over her earthly comforts and stability. And she chose faith over her profession, because she's later going to acquiesce and put away her harlotry, as we're going to see a little while later after Jericho is destroyed. And so here's what I'm trying to say. Faith that does not force us to change our life is not saving faith. Okay? Simply believing something or simply having done something, as necessary as those things are, they are foundational, yes, in reaching that point. But faith that doesn't send us on a trajectory that changes our life is not saving faith. Now, Albert Barnes observes, and also let me say, I understand that this happens at different paces for different people. I understand this isn't necessarily something everyone's just going to at the point of being baptized, that they're going to say, okay, I'm going to overhaul my life. For some of us, that was a long process. For some of us, we are still in that process, and it's one we are truly trying to perfect, although we never will hear. But that overhauling as faith, we begin to realize faith touches more and more components of our life. That is a demonstration of one who understands what saving faith is. That faith, saving faith is not just this mere belief in our mind that we point back to and say, well, I've checked that off. I'm good with God. But no, it's ever increasing, ever drawing near to God, ever purifying one's life. And so Rahab's faith forces her to change her life, and that's what saving faith is going to do. Saving faith requires and demands that of us. So Albert Barnes observes, the same reports which worked faith and conversion in the harlot caused only terror and astonishment among her countrymen. Can you think of an event in Jesus' life that was similar to this, where this great act of power is performed? People were afraid. It produces fear, as the power of God rightly should within someone's life. But then it doesn't lead to saving faith. Can you think of that instance, Dave?
Well, one of the times would have been when they went to get him in the garden. He said, "Who are you seeking?"
Yeah.
Everybody fell after.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good one. I didn't think of that one, but that's true. That the power of Jesus, he says, when they say, "Who are you seeking?" They say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am he." They all fall back on the ground and topple over like dominoes. That should have produced in them a knowledge that, okay, yes, I see God's power. Since the fear didn't produce saving faith. Good. Cole?
I'd say Lazarus is the one that jumps out to me is, you know, when he brings him back from the dead, you know, the Pharisees and the council are all like, well, he's done another miracle. What can we say about this? And
okay.
Then, you know, they sought all the more to heal him.
Yeah, that's another good one. Apparently, I didn't think about this question enough because I just had one thing come to mind. I'm thinking of the demoniac that Jesus cast all of the demons, the legion demon out of, and he sends them into the pigs. And they go and the city comes and they say, God's power has been witnessed. Yes, we are terrified and we want you to get out of here just as quick as you can. Okay, that's kind of the instance I saw. I connected to that. But guys, thanks for bringing in those extra points there. Extra credit for you today on those. So you see, God's power produces fear within man. Sadly, that does not always lead to saving faith. So oftentimes, in fact, what we're going to see is that it doesn't lead to saving faith. So after this confession of faith, what request did she make of them?
Spare her and her family.
Okay, spare her and her family. Verses 12 and 13. Therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So both the life of Rahab and the spies are hanging in the balance because she still got them there, and they don't have a way out. But she also realizes that her life is in the balance as well because Jericho has been condemned and is going to be destroyed by Israel. And so you think about it. She says, I swear by the name of Yahweh that you'll protect me. And as question six, what stipulation did the spies place on the promise? Yes, we'll spare you on the basis of what? Okay. Yep, hanging the cord out the window. Three things I picked up.
You had to keep
quiet about them. Yep, all right. Don't tell anybody our business. Hang a scarlet cord out of your window and then gather your family into the house and don't let them leave. And that was what was required for her family to be saved. So the spies know they owe their life to Rahab and they promise to preserve her and her family. And she obviously has to keep their secret. So she risked her life and she makes this promise to them. And they say, okay. We'll our life for yours, essentially. You hold our secret. You hang the scarlet cord out the window. We'll spare you. Bring everybody you want to be saved into the house. Dad?
You know, she risked her life more than just putting up spies. When she hung a silver up on the scarlet cord out the window, she was going to be asked about that. She didn't know when they were coming. They didn't tell her, all right, 10 days from now, the city's going to fall. If she's like me, she wouldn't have risked being too late. She'd have done it prematurely.
Yeah, and I think that's what she does. As soon as she lets them down, she puts the cord out the window.
And not only that, she's got to keep quiet about it, but her whole family has to keep quiet about it.
Needless to say, it would have been a few very tense days, wouldn't it, from the moment that this occurred until then. Okay, we're going to pick up with the scarlet cord next week. So thank you for your comments and your participation in class. Be looking at those discussion questions. I think they're going to really probe us, and I want us to just think of them in the big picture of the Bible and kind of think about them. There's a lot of relevant things that are there, I believe, and so I'm hopeful to have some fruitful discussion next week when we consider the discussion questions and finish up with the